First, thanks to Mark Turin for insisting to my higher-ups that I be fully funded and sent to Cambridge for this. A disclaimer, two disclaimers, actually. I'm not a linguist, and I am not a language specialist. In fact, as a native Texan, I don't even speak English very well. But I'm an archaeologist by training. I'm a technologist by temperament. And in my capacity at Yale, I'm something of a geospatial Swiss Army knife. So I'm asked to consult on projects from departments as diverse as epidemiology to archaeology, forestry, anthropology, and so on. And so often when I'm asked to speak at things like this or to speak to groups, I feel not so much like a fish out of water, but as like a fish in the wrong pond. But hopefully, I want to ask, how many people do field work? Still. Excellent. How many people work with historic collections and archives? Excellent. Okay, I hope this is going to be relevant to you. I think it will be. Subject creep. So that's a horrible title for this presentation. About 2 weeks ago, I attended a seminar presented by the Society for the Preservation of Natural History Collections, and it was a workshop on geocoding. And it was a workshop on geocoding collections with localities that weren't specific and how you handle that. And so and as I've watched the other presenters talking about their collections, and I've seen some of the Google mashup maps that they've created and looked at the maps in the back, I'm struck by the fact that maybe this will be relevant, because everybody seems to be depicting the location, the spatial location of their cultural objects as points. And I'd like to discourage you from that today, and I'm going to explain why. And I'm going to explain, hopefully, how you can prevent yourself from doing that. So I'm going to obsess on something a little bit called uncertainty in spatial location. And before I get started, I'm going to go through this fast, and I talk a little bit fast. I promise by the end of tomorrow I will have a page up on the Yale GIS support site that will have links to every resource that I discuss in my talk. And that's it. So let's get started. I'm going to do... We don't have presenter mode, so I'm going to do a little double-fisted... presenting here. What is a location? So we'll talk about that a little bit. In the context that I'm discussing today, a location is a set of coordinates that describe points, lines, or polygons that describe the locality where some cultural object or event took place and was recorded or collected. And so these locations are based on something called a geographic coordinate system. A geographic coordinate system is a coordinate system that locates things using typically lat-long coordinates on the three-dimensional globe, on the oblate spheroid that is the Earth. And the model that is used for the shape of the Earth is referred to as a datum. And datums, it turns out, are very important when you're trying to locate things, especially from historic collections, on a map. Projected coordinate systems are coordinate systems that take that set of coordinates and place them on the Euclidean plane, on a flat screen, on a flat paper map. And they're how we typically work with map data. And when you project geographic coordinate systems, you sacrifice much of what's important about geographic space. So when you project from a geographic coordinate system, you do so in order to preserve something about geographic space. If you're interested in measuring area, then you throw away direction, distance, and shape in order to preserve area. And that's the phenomena that you see here, where you have the generating globe that has nice circles, and then you have a projection that is conformal, it preserves shape, but obviously it throws away area, it sacrifices area. And so there are 4,600 projections supported in the most popular GIS platform, ArcGIS. That's how many projections there are. And they work on different parts of the globe in differential ways, and so it's important to understand them at least a little bit. So field work. So we'll start with that really quickly. How do you capture things when you're out in the field? Well, the simplest way, obviously, is with a GPS unit. But is a GPS unit, you know, when you go out and you capture a location with a GPS unit, you might think that that's very, very specific. But it turns out that there is quite a bit of uncertainty in that. And so let's talk about how many people have a GPS unit and use it in the field. So that's not nearly as many people that as said they do field work. And I'm always surprised by the fact that researchers often come to me and ask me, oh, I need to get a GPS unit. How do I set it up? What should I get? It's always sort of an afterthought when you go into the field when you're capturing data. Something that costs less than the ticket on the train from London to Cambridge ought not be an afterthought when you're doing field work. So how does GPS work? Just very quickly, it works through trilateration. We have this constellation of satellites that's orbiting the Earth at all times, about 11,000 kilometers away. And what these satellites do is they send out essentially a signal that has their position and the time that the signal left the GPS satellite. When that is intercepted by your little GPS unit or your iPhone or your Android phone and so on, the unit that intercepts that signal calculates what's called a pseudo-range from the time difference between when the signal left the GPS satellite and it arrived in the unit. And by doing that, it can tell how far you are at that moment from the satellite, from the GPS satellite. So what you can do, what that builds is a bubble around the GPS satellite. And if you get two GPS signals, you are at the intersection of those two bubbles. You are somewhere on that circle. If you get three GPS satellites, you are at one of two discrete points, the intersection of those three bubbles around the satellites. And typically you need four signals to get a lock on where you are on the surface of the Earth. This all depends on an accurate model, again, back to datums, of the Earth. And I just want to say, don't ever collect GPS data in local coordinate systems, projections, and so on. Don't use UTM. Don't use the European datum. Use WGS84. Why? Because it's what the GPS system uses. And it is the most accurate system for capturing GPS data. And it can be projected or transformed to essentially any other coordinate system and or projection that you want to. If you always use WGS84, then there is no confusion whatsoever about what coordinate system these lat-long coordinates that you're using are in. So how do you choose a GPS? The two things that people most often ask me about is how do you choose a GPS unit and how do you use a GPS unit? And so here are my bullet points for choosing a GPS unit. You want it to be rugged, obviously. Sometimes you're working out in the middle of nowhere. Waterproof is dirtproof. So you get yourself a nice waterproof GPS unit. Garmin eTrex, they're just little $80 units. I've been using one for 10 years, and I've abused it to no end, and it will not stop working for me. AA batteries. I can't stress enough how important it is to use equipment that runs on AA batteries. Just try plugging your iPhone in if you're mapping in Kibera, Kenya, or in the middle of the Mongolian steppe, 200 miles from the nearest plug. You can carry as many AA batteries as you need. The whole world's electronics run on AA batteries. So make sure you use AA batteries. A USB connection. That's important because it makes things easier to get makes it easier to get the data out of the GPS unit. Many GPS units still have these proprietary connections with cables that are very expensive, and the price difference between a USB and a proprietary is often less than the cost of the cable itself, and they need drivers and things. You don't want to have to worry about that. Barometric pressure altimeter. GPS is notoriously inaccurate at measuring altitude. My little eTrex has something called JumpMaster. It's a little program on it called JumpMaster, and it's for skydivers. And I would stress, don't ever jump out of an airplane using a GPS unit to tell you how far above the surface of the Earth you are, because you might hurt yourself. A barometric pressure unit, and these don't increase the cost of GPS units very much, when properly calibrated at a known elevation, will give you plus or minus 10 meters of elevation accuracy. Without it, at best, you're going to get plus or minus 50 meters of elevation. Make sure that it takes both waypoints and track logs. A waypoint is just, you know, you're standing in a location, you tell the unit, take my position, and it does it. It gives you a lat-long coordinate and an accuracy reading. A track log is a way you can automate that process. So if you're doing a survey of some sort, or you're walking around, collecting, well, in archaeology we do walking survey and we collect things off the ground and take photos of them. You can set up a track log to take an automated point every second, every 10 seconds, every time you move 10 feet. And so you want to make sure that you have the capacity to do that. And essentially all GPS units have that capacity. And keep it simple. You don't need a camera. You don't need a color screen. What you need is rugged, AA, barometric pressure unit. Just keep it simple. Don't try to use your iPhone. Don't try to use your Google phone. Not only is it going to be difficult to charge them out in the wild, but they actually don't work very well as GPS units, except for, you know, embedding relatively loose lat-long coordinates in your snapshots of your kids. All right, how to use it. So when you record GPS data, you can use the waypoint facility of a GPS, and that's fine. You can record your locations in the GPS, but you always want to also make a paper record. And that paper record should have several things in it. And first and foremost is the locality, a description of where you are, and an accurate description at that. Why, if you're taking GPS coordinates to five decimal places, would you need a locality? But, well, because GPS coordinates, when they're transcribed or re-entered or transferred, can be corrupted, and you want some way to verify that location. If all you have is a spreadsheet of lat-long coordinates, there's no way for you to verify that lat-long coordinate goes with a particular locality. So you still want to do it the old-fashioned way. Write down where you are. You're 5 miles due north of a particular location, and so on. You're situated 5 miles upriver of some village, and so on. Obviously, the coordinates. You want to record coordinates to at least five decimal places. That gives you about 1.5 meters of precision. Most units can only, commercial grade units can only muster about 3 meters of accuracy at any rate. Extent. So if you collect a lat-long coordinate, and then you walk around collecting the objects that you're interested in. In archaeology, we might walk around a site. Your site is not a single point. Your site is that entire extent within which you're collecting whatever it is you're collecting. Elevation. You want to, of course, record elevation, and again, barometric pressure unit. The datum. Well, obviously, if you're using a modern GPS unit and you're following my advice, your datum's always going to be WGS84, so that goes without saying. And the GPS model is also important. That's sort of your reference data for collecting GPS. Just a little word about planning a GPS survey. If you Google Trimble planning software, and again, I'll put a link to this. This is a free piece of software that you can enter the location you'll be doing your GPS survey on, the date that you'll be doing your GPS survey on, and any anticipated obstructions to the sky. And it gives you a plot. If you look in the upper right corner, that's called a dilution of precision plot. And where you see those spikes in the dilution of precision plot, those are fantastic times to take a break and have lunch or tea or things like that. So this is a free piece of software that can help you beforehand plan and get the best out of your GPS unit. Gives you plots of where in the sky. You know, GPS accuracy depends a lot on the geometry of where GPS unit satellites are, how many of them you have access to, and so on. All right, geocoding. So in this context, geocoding is taking a locality in text form and turning it into a set of coordinates and an uncertainty measurement. So in this case, this is from a record from the Oral Literature Project. These gentlemen are playing nose flute, which I thought was cool, so I used this one. And the locality is Bursai near Grik, Perak, Malaysia. Well, how do you express that? You wouldn't want to express that as a point, because obviously there's a lot of uncertainty in where that actual location is. And so what you would want to do is plot a point at the center and then give it some uncertainty so that you can express in cartographic terms that this location is not discrete. There is some uncertainty in where this object was collected and so on. And a lot of times localities have this sort of uncertainty built into them. So here are some localities from a database. So we have Bursai near Grik. You have an actual street location. Now, we're all used to entering street locations in Google Map and having it pop up the little bubble, and we're used to thinking that that's very precise and absolute. But if you've ever entered a rural address, you know that it can be very imprecise because of the algorithm that's used to locate those locations on the street network. You have locations here 3 miles west of San Jose, Cartago border on Highway 2, so on. So these are iterations of localities in historic collections that you might, these types of locations you might run across. Sheep Island is actually a historic name, doesn't exist anymore. And so I'll talk about resources for finding and geocoding. Yes? Does that mean I have 4 minutes left? Oh my God, really? Okay.
So if Sheep Island doesn't exist anymore.
It does exist. It's not called Sheep Island anymore. All right, so how do you handle between two locations? Well, you have to create an uncertainty bubble that encompasses those two locations. So if you've got a locality that tells you that it's between two locations, well, you have to encompass all of the space between those two locations. Uncertainty can be derived from the locality extent. If you're 5 miles north of Cambridge, well, is that 5 miles north of the center of Cambridge? What point in Cambridge is that? So your uncertainty for 5 miles north of Cambridge is as wide as Cambridge. And actually, it's wider because you have uncertainty. Let's see. You have uncertainty in imprecise directions. So if I say we're 5 miles northeast of Cambridge, that's actually a radial. And, we have to go from north-northeast to east-northeast and encompass that entire area as the possible geocoded location of that locality. Imprecise distances, the same way. So if you just have a latitude and longitude to the nearest minute, then you have imprecision in that measurement. If you are measuring only to the nearest kilometer instead of the tenth of a kilometer, you have imprecision there. Cartographic imprecision, those are coordinates. We've covered that. I'm going to go a little bit faster now. It's uncertain. So the scale of a map. If someone used a map to map the localities, the scale of the map itself can introduce uncertainties. So if you think about the fact that a 1 to 250,000 map, you have a line that represents a river that is 1 millimeter wide, I think that comes out to about 1.25, 1.25 kilometers. That's how wide that river would have to be accurately represented on that map. So you have some uncertainty there as well. And the datums. If you don't know the datum that your coordinates were plotted on, this is the amount of error just in North America with an uncertain datum. And you can see up to 470 meters of uncertainty as you move west in North America. And then your GPS unit can get all scrambled up by what's called multipathing. So since the GPS location is dependent on the time it takes for the signal to travel to the unit, if your signals are bouncing off of things like buildings and so on, then the time is going to be longer and that precision is going to be diluted. All right, geocoding standards. Let's talk about this. All of these standards were put together by a consortium of curators who work on natural history collections, mammal collections, herpetology collections, and so on. What is an ideal geocode? So an ideal geocode is a numeric description of a locality that can be placed on a map and that describes the spatial extent encompassed by that description of locality and its associated uncertainties. So I love a slide like that because it's horrible looking and it scares people and they want to read it. But here, this is a standard called Darwin Core that the natural history collections people use, and they've developed it. And the location part of this metadata standard is fantastic. And I would suggest anyone interested in geocoding take a look at Darwin Core and the location terms in Darwin Core. And of particular interest is the decimal latitude, longitude, and uncertainty in meters. This describes, guidelines. So the HERPnet guidelines, I'll put a link to that, but the main thing to remember about this is that these methods are hopefully universally applicable. And these are the localities, the types of localities that these guidelines describe. So from a named place down to a dubious location, one that can be found, offsets from a river, along a river, and so on. So they have managed to create guidelines for geocoding essentially any locality that you might run across in a historic collection. Everything from between two places, very specific guidelines about how you map that, down to how not to geocode certain dubious localities. Geocoding tools. All right, just running this real quick. Geolocate. It is a project of the University of Tulane. This is an engine that you can plug in your localities to, and it will give you the center location and the uncertainty in meters. And so that's how I produced this. I just plugged that locality into Geolocate. And what's nice about it is it's automated. You can do batch processing. You can do collaborative work. You can sign up for an account on Geolocate. You can assign other people pieces of your data set. You can have some authority over committing to the database. There's lots of export options. And it also has excellent APIs for creating your own web apps. You can embed it in your own web pages. They have an embeddable client as well. This is, if you have lat-long coordinates that were created using maps, you can use the georeferencing error calculator, and depending on the scale of the map that was used, whether you use GPS and so on, it calculates the center point as well as the error distance. Very quickly, I'll go through these. So if you're looking for alternative place names, the Getty Thesaurus of Geographic Names is an excellent source. So that example of Sheep Island is in here, and it tells you the modern analog name for a lot of older names. Global Gazetteer, another a gazetteer that does the same thing. Acme Mapper is excellent because if you can locate a locality here, it gives you precise lat-long coordinates and so on. The NGA, GeoNet, this is actually the basis for many of the geocoding engines that are used for this type of work. FuzzyG, this is a great one because you can enter the wrong spelling of locations and it will give you a choice. It will give you many choices. So here, Delgarkhan Ul is a site that I worked at in Mongolia and I don't know how to spell it. And so I put it in there and it gave me all of these choices and it actually did identify where Delgarkhan Ul is. Google Earth, of course. Geonames.org. This is a service that you can leverage using automated web URLs and in conjunction with something called Google Refine. I don't know if anyone's used Google Refine yet, but it's a fantastic application for working with dirty data. And you can leverage the geocoding in geonames.org using Google Refine. I think we'll skip cartographic presentation. How about that? Because I think we're going to talk about this project. Someone's going to talk about the Endangered Languages website, I hope, because it's beautiful and it's fantastic. And not surprisingly, it was done by Visuality, which is a great group. I'll put links to this stuff at this website, bit.ly/YaleGIS. You can find links to all of these resources online. And just one last thing, I wanted to, for our endangered script guy, I was in Mongolia last summer, and we actually, on that rock right there in the middle of nowhere, found Imperial Mongolian script written down the side of that rock, which I thought was cool. Yeah. And there it is. and just barely see it. And we had someone from the Mongolian parliament who could actually read it and read it. And it's the equivalent of Kilroy was here, but it was still it was very cool. All right, I think that's it.